calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, is that mic hot. Yeah, there we go. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from Coos Bay, Oregon, to Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and all places in between. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call into the program. TomHartman.com, the website, will get you there. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room or participate on our blog, our message boards, more than welcome to do so. The lots in the news right now, and broadly speaking, Andy, how do you, is it Foy? Whoops, let me push the right button here. Hey, Andy?
Yeah, hi, I'm here, Tom.
Hey, Andy, welcome to the program. Tell me how to pronounce your last name.
Foyce,
okay, F-O-I-S. I didn't know right. If it was the, I think the French pronunciation would be a silent S, but maybe not. In any case, thanks for being with us. The filibuster is in danger of being nuked, I guess is the right word. Tell us about this. Tell us the history of this and what's going on with this. Let me, by the way, just let our listeners know, you served as Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legislative Affairs at the Department of Justice under President Bill Clinton. So you're relatively uniquely qualified or positioned to understand these kinds of issues. You've been on the inside here. So tell us about the filibuster.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. I do come from a position where, as part of my job in the Justice Department, I was responsible for seeking the confirmation of Clinton judges. And I have another sort of personal perspective in that I myself, in the year 2000, was a Clinton judicial nominee. I'm not a judge today because I was stopped by a filibuster of one Republican senator. I never got out of committee, much less to the floor. So I sort of have a double perspective on this. And the situation is that as Senator McCain, a reasonable Republican, says, the majority led by Senator Frist are undertaking an assault on a 200-year-old rule that is an important part of the constitutional scheme of checks and balances between the minority and the majority in the Senate and the President and the Congress, and that rule is the ability of the minority to filibuster legislation, to filibuster nominees of any kind, and the requirement that 60 senators be voting in support of ending that filibuster. And the so-called nuclear option that we've heard about would be an encroachment by the majority on that rule, and to use a series of parliamentary maneuvers in order to get it to the point where only not even a majority, but even possibly just 50 senators plus the vice president could override the filibuster rule and allow every nominee to come to the floor for a vote.
And the fate of this is going to be, how do you think this is going to play out?
Well, right now it looks like both sides are pretty much dug in. There is some talk between the majority leader, Senator Frist, and the minority leader, Senator Reid, and some other senators like Bill Nelson and on the Democratic side and Arlen Specter on the Republican side to work out a compromise. But right now, bigger forces are at play. There's Republican presidential politics for 2008. Senator Frist and other potential candidates are beholden to some extreme right-wing ideological groups in the Republican Party in order to get their support, or at least not incur their wrath come 2008. To a certain extent, Democrats are committed to some of their own interest groups who are very much supportive of stopping these judges. So it looks right now as if things are headed for a showdown vote. The wrinkle is that neither side is entirely confident about whether or not they're going to have the votes, and that frankly is probably the only reason why the vote hasn't happened by now. Senator Frist is not sure he's going to get 60, Senator Reid is not sure he's going to be able to prevent there to be 60 for cloture, and Senator Frist is not sure he'll have 50 or 51 votes for the nuclear option. But if I had to bet right now, I'd say that's where things were headed.
You think it's going to work? You think that Frist is going to make it happen?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think they're pretty much dug in. I think the fact that any compromise from either side is going to require something that the other side just can't live with. You know, for the Democrats to compromise, they have to maintain the principle of the ability to filibuster, any judge at any time. And for the Republicans, they say that's the one thing they can't compromise on, that, you know, that they have to have a vote on every single nominee. So how you work that out, it's kind of hard to see.
Now, when you were with the Clinton administration, a lot of the judicial appointees that Clinton sent up, my understanding is 35% of them were never received a vote in the Senate, whereas only 5% of Bush Jr.'s nominees have not received a vote in the Senate. Why all the whining?
Well, that's exactly right. At the end of the Clinton administration, there was still 60 judicial nominees. That was a big percentage, and something like 200 executive branch nominees that had been filibustered way short of the floor. You know, the use of the word filibuster, it's just a tool. It's just one technique that only the minority has. The Republicans were in the majority, so they didn't have to resort to the filibuster. They bottled up nominees in committee. They didn't give hearings. They didn't give votes. They never let a nominee get to the floor calendar. If it was on the calendar, they never called the nominee's name up for a vote. And that's what happened to me. As I said, I was stopped in the committee by just the chairman. I had a majority support on the committee, a majority support on the floor, but never got anywhere near there. And,
so you, Andy Foyce, are one of those nominees. You weren't a judicial nominee. You were an appointment, right?
Well, yeah, no. My presidential executive branch appointment was confirmed years before, but in the last year of the Clinton administration, I was nominated to a kind of a minor trial court position here in Washington D.C., and that's what was stopped. I was stopped by one senator who isn't in the Senate anymore now, interestingly, because he was angry at the Justice Department where I worked for some of the positions that we had taken over the years over some of his activities.
Which senator was that?
Oh, it's a senator who you can see now on television playing another role, Fred Thompson, who plays a district attorney in some of the Law and Order programs.
Huh.
And he ran, you may recall, many years ago the investigation into the so-called political campaign contribution scandal, where he believed that the Chinese were infiltrating the political campaign and giving illegal donations to Democrats. And
right.
And during the course of his hearings, the department often threw, it was my job to communicate views to the congressional branch. And so the department took certain neutral positions during the course of that investigation that angered him. And so he took it out on me when it was my turn to be confirmed.
Remarkable. Remarkable. Yep. We're talking to Andrew Foyce. He has served as Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legislative Affairs of the Department of Justice under President Bill Clinton. Andy, what do you think are going to be the long-term consequences of the nuclear option, of the end? Actually, before we get to that, do you think that the way that the Republicans are framing this, particularly Frist, that they're only going to do this as it regards to appeals court judges, that it's going to be a very narrow exemption from the filibuster rule, that the filibuster will still remain intact by and large overall for other larger issues, and that they're just trying to, give their judges an up or down vote, which you, when you were nominated as a judge, were never given because of Republican obstructionism. But nonetheless, that they say that this is just a very narrow thing. Do you really think, A, that it's really a narrow thing? And B, do you think that the long-term consequences of this are going to be more general? And what, if so, what might they be?
Well, as to A, as you say, Frist is saying that he wants to eliminate the filibuster for circuit court nominees that are pending now, any Supreme Court nominee that comes up in the future, but not, for some reason, district court nominees. Now, if there's anything that's more constitutionally and legally absurd, I'm not sure I've ever heard of it. They'd like to call their approach the constitutional option as opposed to the nuclear option. But under what constitutional theory would some judges be filibusterable but not other judges, and ones that are pending now and ones that are coming in the future but not other ones that are pending now but not legislation?
Isn't the real bottom line here that this is a dress rehearsal for and set up for the Supreme Court nominations?
Well, absolutely. Those are the bigger stakes, because Court of Appeals judges are important. District Court judges are less so, though, so that's why they're going to leave the filibuster for that, say the Republicans. But the big enchilada is the Supreme Court nominations, and almost everyone in Washington is expecting there to be at least one. The Chief Justice is very ill, and very few people expect him to be coming back for another term.
So by drawing a bright red line underneath the appeals court judges, who are one step below the Supreme Court, they're basically saying everything above this line you can't filibuster, which would just by coincidence include the Supreme Court nominees.
Right. Right. Now, what does that mean long term?
Right.
Well, a lot of people suspect that this is just the beginning, that district court nominees will be next, and that legislation will be next, and that once the majority has a taste of this aggrandizement of power, that they're not going to be able to stop it just this first step.
And therefore, what? We may see the majority...
The Democratic response. Right. The Democratic response will be to use the full extent of the Senate rules to push forward its own agenda, to force votes on matters like jobs and minimum wage and environment and health care that are important to Democrats.
But Andy, why aren't they doing that already?
That's a good question. The answer is...
Is it because Democrats should be spelled W-I-M-P?
Well, perhaps, but they also, Democrats are also patriots, and the fact is that the Senate majority is in the Republican hands, and the Senate has to work, if it's going to work at all, by unanimous consent, by cooperation between the majority and the minority, and it would be, slightly irresponsible, I think, and the Democratic senators feel, to totally shut down the Senate, and not allow at least, the legislative work that needs to be done.
But the Republicans aren't respecting this, and they haven't been respecting this for a couple of years. They're not respecting, the history and tradition and the way things normally are done. And yet the Democrats are holding on to it?
Well, it's reminiscent of the Hatfield and the McCoys, and who shot first and who's going to shoot last.
I'm concerned that it's more reminiscent of the Nazis versus the socialists.
Well... I don't know if I want to go there with you, but
you got people here playing absolute hardball, willing to blow up a parliamentary process, a legislative process, and then you've got people on the other side saying, "Well, let's just play nice, let's play by the rules."
Well, yeah, I understand that, but I think we can give the Democrats some credit for trying to use the powers available to them without. Without bringing down the Senate,
yeah. Well, hopefully the American public will figure it out, although, frankly, I suspect that given the lousy quality of infotainment that we have that we call news now, that the average American is going to be clueless about this, unfortunately. But hopefully Americans will figure out that this is a real issue that really and truly affects the future of America, and that the conservatives, the Republicans here, are playing with absolute fire. Absolute dynamite. Andy Foyes, thanks so much for being with us today, Andy.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
I do appreciate it. Keep up the great work there. You're with globalsecurity.org, right?
That's right.
Okay, globalsecurity.org. You can find out more information about what Andy's up to. Thanks again, Andy, for being with us. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. Well, it's another Republican family values alert. Southern Baptist told to probe public schools for pro-gay positions. A Houston lawyer who called on Southern Baptist to remove their children from public schools last year is now asking churches to investigate whether schools are teaching acceptance of homosexuality. If churches find that public schools are teaching acceptance of homosexuality, the resolution calls on parents to remove their children and either homeschool them or enroll them in Christian schools. This a resolution to be considered at the Southern Baptist Convention at their annual meeting next month. This is the second largest denomination in the United States. Meanwhile, of course, we learned last week that Neil Horsley, the guy who runs the anti-abortion website where they show pictures of abortion doctors and give their home addresses so that you too can shoot an abortion doctor, one has already died up in New York State. The guy who runs that website, Neil Horsley, admitted on Fox News' Alan Colmes radio show that he'd been getting it on with a donkey. With a mule, actually. A mule is the offspring of a donkey and a horse and is sterile. So I guess that's his idea of birth control. And then we also discovered last week that Dr. W. David Hager, the Christian anti-abortion activist and obstetrician-gynecologist who George Bush Jr. appointed as to the FDA's Advisory Committee for Reproductive Health Drugs in 2002, and who has made a campaign out of banning RU486 and Plan B, the morning after pill, the author of the book As Jesus Cared for Women, a member of the Focus on the Family's Physician Resource Council and the Christian Medical and Dental Society, that he says, even though I was trained as a medical specialist, it wasn't until I began to see how Jesus treated women that I understood how I, as a doctor, should treat them. Well, according to his ex-wife, Linda Davis, formerly Linda Carruth Hager, he treated women in a most un-Jesus-like fashion by sodomizing her against her will. Davis claims he sodomized her, raped her, from 1995 till the time of their divorce in 2002. She says, I probably wouldn't have objected so much or felt it was so abusive if he just wanted normal sex all the time, but it was painful, invasive, and totally non-consensual nature of the sodomy that was so terrible. She also told The Nation magazine that Hager had extramarital affairs, pressured her to let him videotape them having sex, and paid her to perform sex acts she hated, like this sodomy stuff. And he would leave $2,000 on the dresser and say thanks very much as he left for work. And she did not feel real well about that. So now, in the midst of all this, Republican Family Values Week, apparently, Neil Horsley comes back on the Alan Colmes show. Neil Horsley, who had previously admitted to having sex with animals, he comes back on the Alan Colmes show. It's sort of like our official Green Acres time. And Neil Horsley has a new story for us. This Neil and Alan.
Have you ever had sex with a washing machine?
Well, I had never really thought about it. But
washing
the fact
machine?
Of the matter is, if it shakes, and there have been times, I'm sure, when in reality that would be an option.
I'm telling you, lock up your washing machines. The Republicans are coming.
You are known for your anti-abortion secessionist, I might say, and anti-homosexual views. Have you ever had a gay experience?
What good will it do if I sit down and I will tell you this, and this should cover everything.
Wait, hold on. You'll tell me you did it with a mule, but when I asked you about it with another man, that you're afraid to talk
no,
about.
Yeah, he does, well, he gets around to it, but first the watermelon.
Let's get it on the record, Neil. Before you found Jesus, you had sex with a man, right?
Certainly. I've had sex with anything that would move. If we had a warm watermelon out in the field, I might give it a name.
If we had a warm watermelon out in the field, I might give it a name. Well, he goes on to say that he did not actually rape the mule. The mule consented. And he also said that the mule was clearly a whore because it accepted a gift of an ear of corn for the sexual act. If you're doing a double take on that piece of information, NewsHounds, newshounds.us note, I should advise you, he really said it. He also said that it was only one mule. Therefore, Alan Colmes pointed out, at least you were a monogamist. At least he was faithful to his mule. This is the guy who says that he should be in charge of telling women what they can do with their bodies. Do you get this? This is the guy who says, here's how to kill abortion doctors. Something wrong with this picture.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Big wheels keep on turning, carry me home so I can...
And welcome back, my friends. Well, while it may seem like the biggest story of the day is Neil Horsley admitting on national radio, the guy who runs the website where you too can find an abortion doctor near you to murder, he's already got one notch in his belt. That this fanatic anti-abortion guy who would presume to tell women what they can do with their bodies with the force of law, that he has admitted on national radio that he's had sex with donkeys and covets watermelons and washing machines. And also a rather underreported story, I would say. I think probably the most underreported story is the smoking gun memo out of London, out of the UK. This is a major story, and we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that in just a moment with Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. First, let's just take a couple quick calls here. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Very provocative show.
Yeah, thank you.
I think I'll stay away from donkeys and watermelons.
And if you missed the first couple of minutes, I wanted to apologize to our affiliates. We had a crash in our satellite feed here for the first minute and a half of the show. So if something funny was going on there, it wasn't a conspiracy, and it wasn't the sunspots. It was, or it may have been. I don't know. It's just all of a sudden our satellite link dropped. But we're back up.
I wanted to talk about the judicial filibusters, and I think you made a good analogy there, even though your guest didn't seem to want to touch it. The only thing is, it wasn't really even the socialists that caved into the Nazis in Germany. It was actually the Communist Party. They said that
I know, but
the socialists were social fascists. And, you know, if the Nazis took over, things would be so bad that the people would get sick of it, and then they'd go way to the left. Well, 12 years later, after the Holocaust and World War II, that didn't seem like such a good idea, did it?
Yeah, it's just impolitic to refer to them as the communists. Most people don't realize that the communists who were in the parliament of Germany at the time were not Soviet-style communists. They were what today would be referred to as kind of Sweden-style socialists.
Well, no, but they did have a social democratic party as well.
Yeah.
Getting back to this whole point of what the Republicans are doing, you know, they shouldn't really be doing this even for their own good, if indeed they realize that the Democrats will come back into power someday and use the same tactics. Now, the only logical way that they could be doing this is they must think they're never going to lose another election, and they must think these voting machines are just going to keep them in power.
Yeah, it's one of two things. You've got the young guys, the young Republicans, who don't remember what it's like not to have power, and they're just drunk with it. And you've got the old line guys, you know, the John McCains of the bunch, who remember what it was like to be in the minority. And they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we would like to have the filibuster because we're going to be in the minority again. And then you've got this third bunch who are perhaps best represented by Tom Feeney, who is in the House, not the Senate. But nonetheless, Tom Feeney, the guy that Clint Claverne, this computer programmer down in Florida, in a sworn under oath deposition or testimony before Congressman John Conyers committee, swore that Tom Feeney hired him to write software, untraceable software, that would hack the outcome of an election that you could put into a voting machine so that specifically into a Diebolder ESNS voting machine, so that voting machine would record every, and you could program it, every nth vote, every seventh vote, every 50th vote, every 110th vote, whatever, to flip from Democrat to Republican. And in these voting machines that have no paper trail. And, you know, it's a lot of folks say, oh, it's the tinfoil hat crowd. You're a conspiracy theorist to say such a thing. It's there. I mean, there's the testimony. You can find it in John Conyers' book. It's now out in paperback. Pluta in Dallas is on the line. Pluta?
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Hey, Pluta. That's an interesting name. What's up?
I'm just listening to your show this morning. And, you know, while I find this Neil Horsley and Dr. Hagar stuff to be vaguely amusing, you know, that's so well covered by others, and frankly, from you, I expect more.
Well, the tragedy of it, Pluta, the tragedy of it is that these guys, that Hager is the guy who is demanding that women not have access to RU486 or Plan B, and it turns out Plan B doesn't even cause abortion. And these are the guys who want to be telling women in the United States how they should control their bodies, and they're twisted and weird folks. And I think that's worth covering.
Well, I understand on one level.
This isn't just Make Fun of Republicans Week. That's not what I'm doing here, Pluto.
Well, no, it's, every week is Make Fun of Republicans Week. But, from you, I want more than that. I can get that from Springer. I can get that from Alex Bennett and Lynn Samuels and all them. But from you, I want good intellectual reasoning to oppose these people.
Okay, all righty, Pluta. I'll do my very best to give you more of that, and I appreciate your kind comments. In fact, speaking of good intellectual reasoning, Peter Hart is with us. Peter's with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, one of the finest websites on the whole internet, and one of the greatest organizations out there holding the media, holding the press to account. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Glad to have you here with us on the Tom Hartman Show. Tell me about the smoking gun memo. Oh, you have vanished. He's vanished. We lost the call. I hope our phone system isn't crashing here. We had the satellite feed crashing. Everybody is talking about we're having this incredible sunstorm right now. And the sunspots, you know, what might be the consequence of the sunspots? And it might take down phone systems. It might take down power grids. It might take down internet lines. I wonder if we're experiencing it right now. Because this is the second. I noticed that when we were talking with our guest in Grand Rapids, that he suddenly vanished off the line as well, Rick in Grand Rapids. And, you know, whether it's that our phone system has gone a little nutty or whether the sunspots are getting us, not quite sure. But in any case, I'll fill you in on the smoking gun memo. Oh, he's back. Okay, great. Hey, there we go. Hey, Peter.
Does it work this time?
It does. You know,
all right, okay.
I'm speculating, and we had this warning about 2 hours ago that came down the National Wire Service that there's level 5 activity on the surface of the sun. It's as intense as it can possibly get. Level 9 magnitude change in the magnetic field of the Earth, which hasn't been recorded in years and years and years. And they're saying it might crash power grids, it might crash internet systems, the phone lines will be flaky, cell phones might not work. I'm wondering if that's what's happening.
That sounds like a good explanation to me.
Yeah, well, it's I'd rather have that be the explanation than that Alberto Gonzalez didn't like what you were saying.
That's another one, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we were talking about the smoking gun memo. This is the thing that came out just before the election in the UK that may have cost Tony Blair a dozen or two seats in the House of Commons.
You'd think it would be important here, since it deals with British intelligence meeting with their American counterparts and talking about the plans for war. Remember, this is late July 2002, and the head of British intelligence, Richard Dearlove, is reporting back along with a couple of other colleagues in Tony Blair's office, and they're talking about the state of.
Uh-oh, there he goes again. He just vanished. That's interesting. He vanished at the very moment that Scott picked up the line. So I suspect that we're going to have to try and get him back on. But I wonder if that line needs to be reprogrammed somehow. Luigi might want to get Chris or Corey to take a look at it. We're getting back Peter Hart on the line. We're going to try this one more time. In the meantime. In the meantime, let me just... Oh, he's back. One more time. We're going to try this one more time, Peter.
We're going to try to avoid the sunspots.
Yeah, if that's what it is.
Best as we can.
Yeah. So.
But this memo is are the minutes of this meeting, and what it says, and I think the key phrase, and people probably know this by now, but the key phrase was that they thought that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, and that military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD.
Now let me just interrupt you. This and let's place this in time for our listeners. This was in July of 2002 when George W. Bush had not yet gone to the United Nations, had not yet gone to Congress, and was telling the American people that he had no plans to invade Iraq. In fact, Condoleezza Rice was saying this. Is this not correct?
Correct. And they had not yet, obviously, begun the process of going to the UN, which now, historically, we can look back and realize that that was a smokescreen. The memo states that the United States government was not interested in going the UN route. And that was a little more than a fig leaf for
the intentions. It was a charade.
Absolutely. And the one line that jumps out at everyone who looks at this was, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy meaning the invasion of Iraq. Being fixed, as we asked our guest on our radio program, Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, said, does that mean anything else in intelligence lingo? And he said, absolutely not. This is what it means, exactly what you think it means. So you think this must be some sort of smoking gun. We have a courageous whistleblower in the British government who's leaked this. As you mentioned in your intro, it has effect on the election in Britain and has almost no impact on the mainstream media here. We're starting to see it poke into the media. The LA Times did a piece. The Washington Post did a piece on page 18 where they put the important news. And
yes.
I think it was
the obituaries. Right?
somewhere near. I think it was in the sports sports section of some other papers. Yeah. And now we have, I believe, ABC's This Week brought it up with John McCain, who said it didn't sound like the right kind of thing to him. So we're sort of at this standstill where people are pressing the media to devote some resources and devote some time to this. It's hot all over the internet, all over talk radio on the left side of the spectrum, at least.
I'm really and truly baffled by this, Peter. Here we have 1,600 Americans dead. I mean, that's half as many as who died in the World Trade Center. We've got 10, 12, 14, 15,000, 20,000, depending on, and hundreds of thousands, if you include psychological injuries, wounded. That's just Americans. As many as 100,000 Iraqis dead. We're talking dead people, people who valued their life just as much as you and I do, just as much as every one of our listeners do, who desperately didn't want to give up their lives, didn't want to die. All the families that have been impacted by this, the pushing $300 billion in national treasure now, enough to rebuild all of the schools in America, enough to rebuild our highway infrastructure, enough to pay for a national health care system, enough to solve Social Security's problem. It's like what we could do with that money is truly amazing. And it turns out that it was all a lie. It was all a lie. And the press is not covering this. How could they not cover that? They'll talk about whether or not John Kerry got a real wound in Vietnam, as if that's a big story. They'll talk about whether some woman in Georgia who's who's got agoraphobia or whatever really wants to get married. They're going to talk about, you know, who's sleeping with Michael Jackson. But 1,600 dead Americans?
I think, Tom, you're explaining exactly the reason why they're not covering this more than anything else. The story is, in fact, probably too big and too hot and too damaging to the power structure and to the status quo, a power structure the media feel themselves a part of.
But wait a minute. When did ABC, NBC, and CBS start thinking that they were the White House, that they were the Bush administration, that they had a duty to defend the Bush administration against scandals rather than talking to we the people about what's going on? They certainly weren't defending the Clinton administration against scandals with Monica Gate. I mean, oh my God, he had sex in the White House. Let's bring him down.
I think
nobody died. You know, Clinton lied and nobody died.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think the impact of a story has to be measured, and the impact of it on people's perception of whether or not the government tells the truth and whether or not the press can catch them on that. I think this story raises so many questions about the integrity of the administration that it's become almost difficult for the media to report on it. Remember, in the run-up to the election, 60 Minutes had an investigation on how the White House manipulated intelligence in the drive to war. It's a report that CBS viewers never got a chance to see.
And still haven't to this day.
Absolutely not. And the explanation was we CBS, don't want our journalism to have an effect on the real world, which is very the opposite of what journalism is supposed to be. So it's not surprising that they wouldn't take an active interest in this story, I don't think. But it's just depressing and disheartening. What is exciting is the fact that activism is pushing it into the media and making reporters cover it. We have one guy who's been writing the LA Times for weeks and weeks, and he gets a note back from the LA Times saying, you know what, we did our story today, and thanks for sending in the original Times of London piece. We wouldn't have seen it otherwise. Exactly. You know,
UPI is owned by Reverend Moon. And NBC is owned by one of the world's largest defense contractors. ABC is owned by Disney World. I mean, might there be, am I connecting dots here?
I think you're connecting dots that are there. I think that's always something to factor in when you're talking about stories like this.
But because the media went after Nixon and Watergate. They went after Clinton with Monica Gate. Why are they not going after Bush? Is it because because the Bush administration is run like a mafia and they're afraid of him, that they're afraid that they'll all get the Joe Wilson treatment?
I think you have a couple of different dynamics. I think there's so little information being leaked out of the Bush White House because they have such what they like to call message discipline. We can think of other terms for it. So there's very little information that's leaking out that could damage the administration. And reporters aren't apparently able to find this stuff out on their own. In this case, you have a British whistleblower, and that doesn't even get them excited. And that is frankly just inexplicable. But you're right. They did have these relationships with the Clinton White House. that were very contentious, and I think that that was because there were people working in the White House who were willing to feed them information, and there was, as folks like to call it, a vast right-wing conspiracy that was determined to push these stories into the mainstream media, and they succeeded.
So now we need to have a vast left-wing conspiracy, and or a vast, actually, I'd say a vast conspiracy of American patriots. This transcends left or right wing. If the President of the United States lies to the American people about international policy and about war, that, in my mind, is treason, and or something damn close to it. And that's that, whether he's a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, if it had been Harry Truman or Franklin Roosevelt, I would be just as upset. Or LBJ. I still am upset with LBJ for Vietnam. You know, this has got nothing to do with partisan politics.
Yeah, and I think that the duty of a reporter in a situation like this is we're not asking someone to risk their lives. We're asking you to ask the White House, what do you say about this memo?
Yeah, and that is what it has to be, and to tell the American people about the memo. Come on out, tell us what's going on. Tell us how it affected. I was amazed that in all the reporting of the British elections, nobody mentioned the memo because it seemed like the perfect segue. Anyhow, Peter Hart's been with us. Thanks so much, Peter. Fair.org, FAIR.org, for some of the finest information on the press you will find. Tom Hartman with you, 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Today you're working for the man.
Increasingly every day the man has taken over. Well, it's time for us to stand up and take it back. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into the chat room and participate in some of the liveliest, most thoughtful, insightful, intelligent conversations in all of the Internet. Jerry in North Carolina on the line. Hey, Jerry, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program.
How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better, Jerry. What's up?
Yeah, I hear you. I was listening to that little recap you did on Bush's on Bush's practices and how they led to the war.
Yeah.
And it really ticks me off to hear people call into a show I listened to earlier today and blame ABC for the deaths of people because of that of their the item that they ran about the Iran.
Oh, yeah. Well, Newsweek actually is taking the heat for that, not ABC.
Yeah, I mean Newsweek. Yeah.
And Newsweek is not the source of it. I mean, we've got three different detainees now, two of the British detainees who were released and are back in Britain, but three different ones from who didn't, you know, two of them apparently knew each other, the third one didn't. So you got credible sources, I would say, all saying that this was used, you know, that pages were torn out of their Korans, you know, that they were marking up or that were of significance to them, were torn out and flushed down the toilet as part of the softening up process on them. And, you know, and Newsweek is just reporting it. And now Newsweek is, you know, taking so much heat from the Bush administration. And this gets back to the thing that our guest in just a few minutes ago was talking about, is Peter Hart, that they're apologizing. It's like, you know, Dan Rather apologizing. Hey, the story Dan Rather did was right. The memos may have been forged, but they were just backing up. You know, they were like the third, fourth, fifth backup of other sources, first-person sources. Bush did use influence to get out of the guard, and apparently we did flush the Koran down the toilet.
And we can overlook 1,600 deaths.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's what the Bush administration would have. That's what they want. They very much want us to overlook 1,600 deaths.
Hey, the guy that called in a little while ago and complained to you about he expected more from you.
Yeah.
The one thing I expect from you is to tell the truth and tell the news.
Well,
and the news may not be pretty, but I sure as hell want it.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm trying to do both, and you know, and every now and then there's something that's just too entertaining not to do. But I'm not going to do it for a whole hour like somebody else may. It'll just be there for 2 or 3 minutes. We've had enough Neil Horsley, I think. Thanks a lot for the call, Jerry. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, so not some right wing think tank. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to call in, if you have thoughts, concerns, questions, complaints, problems, suggestions, optimistic views for America, anything you'd like, it's just fine. Our chat room, TomHartman.com. Click live chat if you want to drop in there. In an interview with Fox host Bill O'Reilly, this from Media Matters for America, Corporation for Public Broadcasting Chairman Kenneth Y. Tomlinson denied ever discussing the public broadcasting service, which he has been criticized for airing. Which Tomlinson has publicly criticized for airing programming that he says shows a liberal bias with Bush administration officials. He's denied that he ever discussed PBS with Bush administration officials. O'Reilly asked him this question. He says, no, I never talked to the Bush administration about PBS. Never did. In fact, the New York Times reported that as Corporation for Public Broadcasting chairman, Tomlinson had previously worked with White House officials, including Senior Presidential Advisor Karl Rove, who, by the way, is a childhood friend of Tomlinson's, on issues related to public broadcasting. Moreover, Tomlinson hired the director of the White House Office of Global Communications, quote, on the recommendation of administration officials, end quote, according to the Times. On the May 12th edition of Fox's News' The O'Reilly Factor, O'Reilly asked Tomlinson, now, you said that you've never had any conversations with any Bush administration officials about PBS. Is that true? Tomlinson replied, that's true. In fact, according to the May 2nd Times article, Tomlinson had worked with the White House officials on, quote, public broadcasting issues, end quote. Here's the actual clip from the New York Times. They said last year he, that would be Tomlinson, enlisted the presidential advisor, Karl Rove, to help kill a legislative proposal that would change the composition of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's board by requiring the president to fill about half the seats with people who had experience in local radio and television. The proposal was dropped after Mr. Rove and the White House criticized it. Are you getting this? Mr. O'Reilly also asked Tomlinson whether he was, quote, firing any Democrats at the CPB, end quote. Tomlinson replied, quote, no, no witch hunts there at all. That's why I'm so surprised about this, end quote. But according to the Washington Post on April 22nd, I quote now from the Washington Post, in recent months, at least three other senior CPB officials with Democratic affiliations, end of quote, departed or were dismissed following the appointment of Ken Ferry, a Republican who had been a top advisor to former FCC Chairman Michael Powell as CPB chief executive. So what's going on here? Why are we getting these mixed messages? Why are we getting multiple stories? Why are we hearing, you know, this way once, that way another time? Well, the bottom line is that there is a battle going on for the heart and soul of public broadcasting. I mean, that's really what it gets right down to, is that there is a war going on, a battle going on for this. And Stephen Labaton in the New York Times writes about it. He says, the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which allocates federal funds for public radio and television, is considering a plan to monitor Middle East coverage. Now, you know, keep in mind, Middle East coverage, this is the stuff, this is the reason why we banned Al Jazeera from Iraq. Oh, democracy's on the march. We're bringing democracy to Iraq. Free press? No, you can't. Go to the next country, please. We've banned over 100 newspapers in Iraq. Why? Because they're seditious. They're talking nasty. We can't have that. And this is just wrong. The court, and so now, same thing. We're going to start censoring news from the Middle East. See, keep in mind, this is George W.'s, this is Bush Jr.'s strong point, he thinks. And, in fact, you go back and you look at why did, for example, so many middle-class women vote for George Bush Jr. in the last election. And you discover that, the so-called security moms, the soccer moms, that they voted for George Bush Jr. in the last election because they were afraid of Al-Qaeda. They wanted somebody to keep us safe, protect us. And Bush's whole, his whole marketing strategy, this is the thing that Karl Rove laid out to him back in 2002. It was right there, you can read it in Bob Woodward's book. You're going to be the guy who keeps people away from fear. You know, there's this old psychological dictum or nostrum or whatever you want to call it, old psychological notion that people are always doing one of two things, that at any given moment in time, right this second as you're listening to my voice, you are doing one of two things. You are either moving toward pleasure or away from pain. You're either moving toward something that motivates you, you're moving toward a positive future, you're moving toward something you want, or you're moving away from something you don't want. It really boils down to that. People never just sit still in the middle. They're always either moving toward pleasure or away from pain. And the moving away from pain strategies are very, very powerful. If you want to motivate somebody to act very quickly, very rapidly, use a moving away from pain strategy. Scare them. And they will act. Unfortunately, a lot of us were raised this way as kids. You know, the moving away from pain strategy, yelling at kids, spanking kids, threatening kids, things like that. It produces instant results, which is one of the reasons, I suppose, why James Dobson and Focus on the Family say that people should hit their children. And, in fact, they should do it often, and they should do it to instill fear in them. Well, the problem is that while this strategy of creating pain and causing people to move away from it does work very rapidly, over time, it also wounds. Over time, it causes people to be mistrustful of the source of that pain. Over time, it causes people not to believe in the authority that pain purports to represent. And this is not a good thing. Not a good thing if you're a parent, not a good thing if you're a political leader. It's not a good thing. So what's the alternative? Moving toward pleasure. To say, we hold a vision of America that is positive. We hold a vision of America where there's a social safety net, where there's security for people, where people don't need to fear, where they can move toward their goals and their dreams, not run away from their terrors. The problem with that is that that's a long-term motivational strategy. That over a period of time, people feel, oh, yes, I'm going to move toward pleasure. But it's a weaker strategy. It's the kind of strategy that over time heals people. It's the kind of strategy over time helps people. It's the kind of strategy that you hold up to people and brings the best out of them. It's what John Kennedy did. It's what Franklin Roosevelt did. It's what Thomas Jefferson did. Arguably, it's what Abraham Lincoln did. It's what many of our great presidents have done, is they've held visions for America, positive visions for America, and said, it's what Ronald Reagan talked about, actually. The things that people remember about Reagan, his shining city on a hill speech, in which he was paraphrasing Walt Whitman, who was quoting somebody else, I forget who now. And it's a positive thing. It's a good thing to say, here's the ideal that we want to move toward. But the problem is that when you have one person who's saying, here's the ideal we want to move toward, and another person saying, be afraid, be very afraid. The person who's saying be afraid, over the short term, will win the argument. And the Bushies and the cons have figured this out. And so they're, be afraid, Social Security is going to self-destruct. Well, in fact, in 40 years, Social Security might run a little short if we continue having the Bush recession. But if our economy gets back to where it was when Clinton was president, There'll be plenty of money for Social Security. We don't have to do a thing. If our economy just gets back to where it was under LBJ or Nixon or Jimmy Carter, for that matter, we won't have to do a thing. Even with a stagflation. No, but they got to scare us. And the biggest scare of all, of course, was Iraq. The biggest scare of all was Iraq. Terrify the American people. Convince the American people the boogeyman is going to come and get us. That nasty Saddam Hussein with his weapons of mass destruction and his unmanned aerial vehicles, they're going to come and get us. And that scare tactic, if challenged, could bring down the whole house of cards that is the Bush administration. This is how high the stakes are. I believe this is why there are so many people in the media today who are reluctant to report about the memo that came out of MI6 that proves that George W. Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, and Dick Cheney lied to us. Lied to us through their teeth over and over again. Lied to the American people in the State of the Union address. Lied to the people of the world in the United Nations. Probably lied to Colin Powell. I'm willing to cut him a little slack on this. I really don't think he was in the loop. Although it's hard to say because Paul O'Neill knew what was going on and he was just the Secretary of the Treasury. He's been saying they lied to us all along. People have been going, that's a cranky old Paul O'Neill. He was just the president of Alcoa. He's just another one of the multimillionaires. You know, don't pay any attention to that man behind the curtain. Well, now it turns out there's proof, irrefutable proof, absolute solid proof. And the media is afraid to go near it. They're afraid to touch it. And you know, what's the, and the question, you know, the folks at FAIR are asking the question, why is the media afraid to go after this? I think it's because it could bring down the administration, because this fear is at the corner of it. And then we get to National Public Radio, which is where I started this whole thing with Tomlinson, this guy at the head of NPR. And he now wants to create a plan. He wants to create an internal whatever, agency, division, bunch of people, whatever you want to call it, inside NPR to monitor their Middle East coverage. Well, in my opinion, this is code for we want to perpetuate the big lie. This is code for the con saying that they want to perpetuate the big lie, that they want to keep it going. They want to keep people afraid. They want people to be convinced that there actually was a danger there. And it's a lie. It's a lie. There was no Iraq threat, represented no threat at all. It represents a threat now. Bush created it. But it represented no threat before. He lied to us. And he knew he was lying. He had people within his own administration telling him he was lying. And we now know that. And that's why the press is afraid to go after it, because this is the card that you pull out of the bottom of the house of cards and the whole thing comes tumbling down. And this, as to quote John Dean, the former Republican, the current Republican and former counsel to Richard Nixon, the former White House lawyer, to quote John Dean, this is worse than Watergate, far worse than Watergate. Nobody died in Watergate. 100,000 people are dead now, 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We say we build democracy, but really build refineries and drill for our prosperity from oil in the ground.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program. But I'm a simple man and that's too difficult. We'll be back with your phone calls in a few minutes, but first, Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our Washington Bureau Chief, and our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I'm actually not in Washington. I'm in New York, but I do have some Washington. We'll start out with the Washington information, and then I'll move on to New York.
Okay.
Because I'm at a political bloggers conference in New York City.
Oh, that should be fascinating.
It is actually very fascinating, and actually Pew just came out with a study today, which you can go on, that said that political bloggers do not have quite the influence that they were said to have had during the last election. Influence the influential, but not quite the hype that was given about political bloggers. In fact, there is some, and I haven't really read through the whole study, but there is certainly some anecdotal information that talk radio had a bit more of an influence.
Interesting. Well, I think we've known for a long time that talk radio, particularly right-wing talk radio, has had a dramatic influence in America, changing the debates and the dialogue and everything else.
Karl Rove certainly says that. Another thing that's interesting is today the president was in West Virginia trying to look very, very green. He came out with a whole lot of interesting initiatives that he wants in his energy bill. Of course, his energy bill may have some green stuck in it, but it certainly has a lot of oil drilling offshore ANWR, which, as you know, we've talked about on this millions of times on this program, that even if you drill to ANWR, it just goes on the open market, doesn't go to us. But he's talking about hydrogen cars. He's talking about renewable fuels. He's talking about, using all the products from corn, et cetera. And he is looking as green as can be because he knows that, you know, I hate to bring this bad name up, but Dick Moore said to me that in fact, he thinks Gore would have won the election with quite a huge margin had he really started to talk about the environment, because that's where a lot of American people are.
Oh, yeah, including the conservative base of hunters and farmers.
That's right, and that's where the Bushies have moved to at this point.
Yeah, well, or they're trying to move to. I'm not sure anybody's taking them seriously.
Well, nobody's taking him seriously, but he's taking himself seriously, and that's how he's trying to sell himself.
Yeah, because his actions so contradict what he's saying.
Okay. Now, we also look like the nuclear option may be coming up on Thursday or Friday, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm. Is the Senate in session on Friday?
I'm sorry. Did I say Thursday and Friday? I meant Wednesday and Thursday.
Okay.
That's what they're talking about now. Now, again, I have had it from a very well-known Democratic senator tell me the Republicans do not have the votes to do the nuclear option, but on the other hand, they have the vice president who is staying in town, in particular, just to deal with this.
Just to be the tie-breaking vote.
Just to be the tie-breaking vote, and they won't say that's what he's in town for. They're just saying that he's in town for several votes.
Yeah. Okay.
So
what's going on in New York?
Well, this political blogging conference is, interestingly enough, talking about the influence of political blogging on the net and also talking about all the social networking that people are now beginning to use and how that will totally influence the next election. It's just meetup.com. And I heard an interesting factoid. Although the Heritage Foundation's town hall was getting, you know, one of meetup.com's sort of biggest customer, and I guess meetup.com was charging them $10,000 a year. They are now pulling out of meetup.com because they don't want to be involved with atheists or liberals on the website.
because Dean was using meetup.com. I mean, that was one of the big things for Democracy for America. That's how it grew out of the whole thing with meetup. So probably what's going on is Town Hall is creating their own version of it, and they're going to charge for it and figure out a way to market it to other conservatives.
You got it. And
yeah.
And they're going to use talk radio to do it.
Yep, there you go. No doubt about it. Oh, well, 29 minutes past the hour. Ellen Radner of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Ellen, for the report today.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again soon. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Speaking truth to power. Talk radio for the rest of us. Right back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 and a half minutes before the hour. Well, that's about the most downbeat bumper music I've ever heard. We got to nuke that bumper music. I just. Forgive the inside baseball talk here. Anyway, welcome back, my friends. Good to have you with us. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartmann.com gets you to our live chat room if you'd like to drop in and say hi there. Let's go to the telephone lines here, see who's up and what they have to say. Tom in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Tom, first thing you should do is get Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer for your music there.
Okay.
And, you know, everybody keeps knocking the Republicans for hating unions. Well, that's not true because they love the Communist Union of Red China.
There you go. And Red China actually does embrace unionism. There is one national union, and you are required to join it, and you have to do whatever it says, and you have no say in it. So it's not democracy in the workplace like unions in the United States. But
and that's by the union that they'd like to bring to this country, too.
Yeah. The Walmart-style union.
Exactly, yeah. If you try to become a union, we'll just move our company someplace else.
Right. Well, we did the same thing in Iraq. We said that unions in the private sector are illegal in Iraq.
Right.
That was Paul Bremer's little treat, thanks to Wolfie, who is now head of the World Bank, where they try to enforce the same thing in third world countries.
And I'd like to say that I agree with that gentleman that called the other day that was saying it's time for the Democrats to stop apologizing and just be very strong on what they do, and with regards to who they talk to, it should be full steam ahead.
Yeah.
And like a hero mindset, it's better to die on your feet than live on your knees.
Yeah, well said. Tom,
talk to you later.
Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Dennis in Benton, Illinois. Hey, Dennis.
Hello, Tom. How you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Great. You're talking about these papers out of Britain on the making up the Iraqi war.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to make you mad here. I'm going to use a line that Rush Limbaugh used way back when Bush Sr. attacked Iraq.
Okay.
He said, if you don't like the illegal war, he said, what are you going to do about it?
If you don't like what?
The illegal war, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
Well, I would like this administration held to account for it, and I think that when the people of the United States figure out that these guys have been lying to us through their teeth, that they will vote them out of office in 2006 and 2008.
Oh, that's not going to happen. I don't believe it, Tom.
Well, you know, I hope springs eternal on my side, Dennis. I'm sorry. You know, you may think that it's just fine for these guys to lie to us, and you know,
that lie is your word.
Well,
I don't
okay.
think they're lying at all. I mean, you sat there and preached this Republican lie all day long, but it's just simply not true. It's the other way around. What the Democrats accuse Republicans of doing, or what the Democrats are doing.
Well, hang on just a second. Here's George W. Bush. In August of 2002, 4 months after the memo in Great Britain said that Bush had informed Tony Blair that he intended to go to war against Saddam and was going to use weapons of mass destruction as the reason. Here's George W. Bush at a news conference. He's asked, are we going to go to war in Iraq?
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
That was a lie. What else, what would you call that if you wouldn't call it a lie?
Well, you're assuming that the papers are correct.
Well, I'm
it's
assuming
like Dan Rather's report was correct.
I'm assuming that what Paul O'Neill, who was in the administration, was correct. I'm assuming that what MI6 said was correct. I'm assuming that when Tony Blair last week said, yes, that is exactly right, that he was not lying to us. I'm assuming that when Jack Straw, the British foreign minister, said, yes, in fact, that memo is accurate, their equivalent of the Secretary of State, that he was not lying to us. I'm assuming that Scott McClellan, when he refused to refute that, and any other administration, no administration official has come forward and said that thing is a lie. I'm assuming that they're all telling the truth. Yes, I'm assuming that that memo was accurate because the United States government is not saying it's not, and the British government, from the top to the bottom, is saying, yes, it's accurate. So here we have George W. Bush.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Lying to us. What do you call it if it's not a lie?
Well, this morning you were quoting three guys that have been prisoners in our war prisons, and you were quoting them as telling the truth. Now, these guys are telling the truth, you said, but administration's lying. Now, these guys are the guys that want you dead.
I didn't say the administration was lying.
And they want your grandchildren
Dennis,
dead.
Dennis,
you put them out as they're telling the truth.
Dennis, I didn't say that these guys who said that as part of the interrogation techniques, parts of their Koran were torn up and thrown down the toilet were telling the truth and the administration was lying. The administration has been saying all along that they had done things like that. It's Newsweek that's backpedaling from the story, and they're not even saying the story's wrong. They're just saying they're sorry they reported it because 15 people are dead now because of the riots around it.
And they doubt their sources.
They doubt a source. They're very carefully parsing their words, Dennis. Go back and read it. They are doubting a source. Just like Dan Rather with the CBS story. Say those memos were totally false. What about all the other people who came forward? The guy who actually got George Bush out of being drafted, jumped him 138 people in front of everybody else in line so he could get into the Champaign unit of the Texas Air National Guard so he wouldn't have to go off to service. You know, it's like parsing words. I mean, you guys parse your words so carefully so that it doesn't quite seem like a lie. But the bottom line is, Dennis, it's a lie.
Tom, you have a good day.
Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate it. And thank you for calling. And feel free to call anytime you'd like. Tim in Illinois on the line. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for making sense to those of us in the reality-based community.
Yes. Well, who was it in the Bush administration who said that we make up our own rules? There was a great, quote. It was somebody in the, well, in any case, yeah. Yeah.
Bill Moyer's 45-minute speech yesterday at the Media Reform Conference in St. Louis just became available for download.
Yeah, well, you can read it on commondreams.org as well.
Oh, great. In his speech, Moyer's for the first time responds to Ken Tomlinson and others. I think it's fantastic stuff, and it's more good journalism by Moyer's.
Yes, one of the few actual real journalists left in America who's willing to actually be a journalist rather than a syncopant, a parrot, or an inflatable, you know, I mean, well, don't get me started. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, yeah. It's great to actually hear the speech. So if folks out there want to listen to him and deliver this speech, it's just a great, inspiring thing, and there's some good journalism in it. And in the speech, he hints strongly that he might come out of retirement to deal with the PBS crisis.
Yeah, that would be nice. That would be nice.
I thought it was great.
But, you know, then there's the question of, you know, where is a real journalist actually going to be able to report real news? Because what we have now is all the corporations are doing infotainment because it gets ratings.
Well,
and PBS is scared to death because they got 6 out of the 9 members of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting now are partisan Republican hacks, most of them without even any experience in broadcasting.
Well, this gets back to a rant that I've had for a long time now. I really believe that George Soros and others have got to get together and somehow get on television. Get people on television who are going to tell us the truth.
Like Rupert Murdoch did, you mean? With Fox News.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is so important.
It's a nice ideal. The reality is that it probably isn't going to happen. I think it's going to probably take more money than George Soros has even, and a lot of media savvy. My hope is that rather than that, some, you know, wealthy white knight come charging in, my hope is that the American people just simply start to wake up and start to say enough of this. And we're seeing this right now. You're finding that in the polls of whether or not people trust the news organizations, they're down 20-30%. I mean, it's in the toilet. Why? Because the news organizations are not reporting the news anymore. Back in the old days, 15-20 years ago, back before Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 96, and back before Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine in 87. Back in the old days, in order to maintain your license, a radio station had to provide for the public, the community service. They had certain public service announcement or public service requirements. And the way that they satisfied that public service requirement was by running news. And so the networks and local stations had news departments that lost money. They knew they were going to lose money. They competed on the basis of status. Who's got the most prestigious news department? Because, you know, that status kind of infected everything else around them. But they were not about making money in their news. They were about reporting the news because the law required it to be a community service. And the FCC was looking over their shoulder saying, are you actually providing a service to your community? And then, you know, after Reagan and after Clinton, it became just another profit center. And so now the question for the networks and for the local stations is, are we making money on our news? And that's why you have wall-to-wall coverage of Michael Jackson and the runaway bride instead of the fact that the president lied us into a war and 1,600 brave Americans, noble young men and women, and some of them not so young, in fact, you know, even people in their 40s and 50s who got dragged over there against their will, are dead. I mean, dead. People like Dennis calling up going, oh, let's play semantics. Let's play word games. Talk to one of their families. Anyhow, pardon me.
Watch out. That's reality-based stuff.
Yeah, there you go. Tim, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. You want to make one point, go for it.
I was going to say, I have a different take on this idea that the public is waking up. I was in newspaper journalism for 30 years, and the entire time, the public had a very poor perception of the news media in general, and thought it was a bunch of elite liberals with a bias to the left.
Yeah.
And I think that's because of this right wing megaphone that's been blaring loudly for 30 years.
Yeah.
And I think this is a residual. This attitude that you see out there is a residual from that.
Yeah,
I'm
and
not
start
sure
start watching the news shows. Start watching Chris Matthews. Start watching the Sunday morning news shows, and just count how many conservatives versus how many real liberals are on there.
Well, yeah,
there's
my,
no
my
liberals.
I'm just not as optimistic to you as you are. I think that the public is not waking up because the public is not seeing on television real journalism.
Yeah.
And
well, broadly, I would agree with you, but I would say that the trend is moving in the right direction. I really believe that. I think the success of this program, the success of Air America Radio, the success of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, the success, you know, the success of the alternate media on the internet, all of these, the fact that Clear Channel Communications is picking these things up and they're saying, hey, we can make money on this, it means that there actually is demand. There really is demand. There really are people out there who want to hear the other side of the story. Tim, I got to move along. I got a bunch of other calls here. Thanks for the call, though. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Tomas in Michigan on the line. Hey, Tomas.
Hey, Tom. I was going to talk about Iraq, but I think I can learn a lot more if I talk to you about the filibuster.
Okay, go for it.
Because, just tell me if I'm wrong, but the House used to have a filibuster, and then got it too big, and they put a limit on it. And the Senate has always been 100, so they've, less, you know, but they've had, I guess, a smaller crowd there, and they've decided they could allow filibusters. In my opinion, I don't think they should have a filibuster. I think it should be just like the House. You know, you get whatever, I don't know how many hours you're allowed in the House, but it seems it's worked well there. And it seems to me that the filibuster has never been used for good causes in history. It was used to help Jim Crow, and it helped the southern states maintain their unequal balance.
Okay, Tomas, you raised three or four points, and they're good points, and they deserve, you know, a thoughtful response. First of all, the filibuster has been used for many good causes, including stopping these incredibly insane judges that Bush is sending up. But beyond that, the Senate and the House are really very different bodies. The House does not confirm judges. The House does not make confirm lifetime appointments. Only the Senate does that. The House and Senate operate by different rules, and they've operated by different rules from the very beginning. Back in 1789, when the Constitution was first ratified, a single senator could block anything from coming out of the Senate. A single senator, one person could filibuster. Those rules were changed in the late 19th century to be a third of the Senate. As you know, and every time we added a state, we added two more senators. So the Senate has been steadily growing all these years. We're up to 50 now, or 100 senators because we have 50 states. But so then it became two-thirds. And then, as I recall, in 1919, somewhere in the 19-teens, they dropped it from a two-thirds requirement down to what it is now. Actually, it might have been more recent than that. In any case, it became, in fact, as I recall, maybe it was in 1919 that they dropped the two-thirds, or that they dropped a single person can do it, and they went to the two-thirds. In any case, now we've got the situation where it requires 60 votes. And the whole point of it is, if you go back and read Federalist Number 10, and I recommend you do this, Tomas, it's a fascinating piece of history. This is written by James Madison, trying to sell the Constitution to the people, and he was arguing against democracy. And he was saying there is a there can be a tyranny of the majority, just as there can be a tyranny of a king. And one of the things that we're doing in our government is we're trying to organize our government in a way that if the majority gets out of control, they cannot impose their will on the people of America if that's against the will of the American
right.
people.
Right. But Psalm 60% is a majority, as much as is even more of a majority than 51%. So it still could be a tyranny.
This is an attempt to say, okay, there has to be some threshold. I mean, at what point do we take the Senate back to the point where it's 99-1?
Well, I just believe that the people in a democracy or a democratic republic, whatever you want to call it, need to be responsible for their actions. When they make a mistake, you know, they need to see that, okay, next time. We're talking
about the lifetime appointment of judges. Also, Tomas, here's another interesting fact. If you take all of the people in the states represented by the Republican senators, they constitute a little more than 30% of all Americans, fewer than 40% of all Americans. If you take all of the states represented by the Democratic senators, even though there's fewer senators, they represent over 60% of Americans.
Well, I tell you.
Should we weight it differently?
Hey, for my opinion, you know, I not only read the Federalist Papers, but I read the papers that Madison wrote before that. Because, as you said, in the Federalist Papers, they're trying to sell the Constitution, and they change a lot of their opinions. And matter of fact, I think Madison was against the way the Senate was formatted as far as...
There was a huge debate about whether the Senate should be directly elected or not. And Madison was in favor of directly electing it, and Adams and Hamilton were against it, and they prevailed. Sure. But that has nothing to do with the filibuster. Tomas, we're out of time. I appreciate the call. You raised some good points, and, you know, I thank you for calling in with them. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I've seen mornings when 1,000 bales of hay look like a mountain to a boy my age.
And welcome back.
I've seen my daddy in that hot southern sun move those mountains one by one. I've seen that same man.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. One of the folks in our chat room, what is it? Moondog. Tom, did you read the story that General Myers says riots in Afghanistan are not about the Newsweek story? Hey, Moondog. No, I haven't read that. I will go looking for it during the break, or maybe you can toss a link up there in the chat room, and I'll check it out during the break at the top of the hour. We can talk about it in the next hour. For right now, however, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Alice in Humboldt County has some words of wisdom for us. Hey, Alice.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I think you were right in saying it correctly. We no longer have free press here because there are too few owners, and these owners won't let their reporters say anything negative about Republicans.
Well, I think it goes beyond that, Alice. I don't think that there's overt censorship. I think that what's happened is that it's all about making money, and entertainment, frankly, is more entertaining, shall we say, than news, and so it gets higher ratings, and so you have all these reporters migrating toward or just naturally moving toward where the ratings are because they want to be stars, and many of them have huge salaries. And so, you know, the Geraldo Riveras of the world, there's this blurring between news and entertainment. But you raise a good and important point, Alice, and I think it's a cogent one for democracy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alice, for being on with us. Armin in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, what's up?
First, I'd like to comment about Dennis. Apparently, he doesn't understand that too much grape Kool-Aid can have an everlasting effect on a person.
the con Kool-Aid, okay.
And I was reading online today that there's a study out that says people in the United States diagnosed as sociopaths has tripled since 1970.
Hmm. And do you think this is the result of what?
Well, I think it's a lot of things. I think it's the environment, it's the media, and it's the criminals running the enterprise.
Well, it could be. It could be that it's contagious from the top down. It also could just be that our diagnostic measurements are getting better. It's really hard to say. Armin, thanks for the call, though, and I'm sure that you wanted to get into something a little deeper than that. Perhaps we can do that in the next hour or later on in the week, actually, would be better. But I appreciate your call. Always good to hear from you. It's Tom Hartman here with you. So much, you know, so many topics here. What's the future of NPR? This is something I think all of us should be concerned about, even though we're on commercial radio. You know, it has to do with the future of democracy. What is the future of partisan politics? Talk radio for the rest of us here. Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's 7 minutes after 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Washington, D.C. As one of the folks in our chat room notes, it would be Moondog. He says, I guess the leader of the free world, the hardest job in the world, is probably riding his bicycle. Welcome back to our program. Isn't you know, at the risk of reducing this to trivia, and it's really not, I don't think, isn't it strange that as his wife is being hustled into a safe room, as Nancy Reagan is being taken into a safe room, nobody bothered to interrupt George? Well, in any case, it's last week's news. It's old news. But apparently still some folks in our chat room think it worthy of comment. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894. Chat room, tomhartman.com. Click live chat. It'll get you there. Representative John Conyers, this from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, article by Sylvester Brown, Jr. Representative John Conyers, a Democrat from Michigan, is peeved. John Conyers, you'll recall, been on this program several times. Good man. One of the finest members of the United States House of Representatives, in my opinion. One of the finest minds, certainly, in the House. And also part of the institutional memory of the House of Representatives. He's been around for a long, long time. So Sylvester Brown says, Conyers can't understand why an explosive story published early this month in England hasn't received more attention here. On May 1st, the Sunday Times of London reported the British government and the United States government secretly conspired to attack Iraq in 2002, a year before the war started. In one meeting, an official suggested Britain and America, quote, create conditions to justify the war, end of quote, the Times reported. Conyers and 88 fellow congressional members sent a letter to George W. Bush, or President George Bush Jr., on May 5th, asking about the troubling allegations. They asked Bush several questions, including whether there was a coordinated effort to fix intelligence to justify the invasion. In a letter sent to colleagues for their support, Conyers took a pot shot at the media. Unfortunately, he said, the mainstream media in the United States was too busy to cover a bombshell report out of the British newspapers. This should not be allowed to fall down the memory hole during wall-to-wall coverage of the Michael Jackson trial and a runaway bride. As of Friday, this would be last Friday, neither the president nor anyone representing the mainstream media has responded to Conyers' letter. So the author of this piece, Sylvester Brown, who himself is a reporter with 17 years of experience, decides, I ought to tell John Conyers what's going on. So here you have it from an actual reporter. Sylvester Brown, dear Congressman, he says, you know, thanks for your letter. You've raised an important issue, blah, blah. He said, with all due respect, the genre has changed. In your day, keeping in mind, John Conyers is in his early 70s, I believe, he said, in your day, news was just news. Guys like Edward R. Murrow, Walter Cronkite, and Bob Woodward worked for news organizations that focused solely on, well, news. Today, the same organizations that deliver information also deliver music, books, coffee, refrigerators, ball games, concerts, fun parks, and weapons of mass destruction. Viacom owns CBS and MTV. NBC is owned by GE, a huge defense contractor, and ABC is the property of Disney. In a very real sense, Mr. Conyers, Disneyland is today's news. Sylvester Brown goes on to say, as you know, there are 12 mega multinational conglomerates that control much of what we see, hear, and read. Each entity can either support or destroy the other. We can't let a silly thing like news jeopardize our refrigerator sales, can we? Remember last year when that bonehead Dan Rather ran a report questioning the president's military record based on bad information? Now that boo-boo almost brought down CBS. See, in the old days, a codger like Cronkite might have still insisted Bush explain his questionable record. That kind of maverick behavior is just plain reckless these days. He says, you mentioned Michael Jackson in your letter. Let me assure you, sir, that 24-hour coverage is no accident. The way we see it, if Jacko's convicted, we sell books, movies, and believe me, his old music will top the charts. If he's exonerated, we sell books, movies, and his new music will top the charts. It's a win-win kind of thing. As far as The Runaway Bride, that series pulled through the roof. It's called the new media, Mr. Conyers. Just as Clinton redefined the meaning of sex, conservatives have redefined the meaning of news. Just look at the Fox cable network. They have superstars like O'Reilly, Hannity, Coulter. Forget news, my friends. These darlings sell books, CDs, coffee cups. They're team players. The lines have been blurred. Yesterday's reporters are today's blabbermouths and bloggers. Male escort, porn star, conservative, and fake reporter Jeff Gannon got a seat in a White House press conferences right next to the cable and network stars. It was 2 years and 200 briefings before anyone caught on, and then it took bloggers to out him. I'm sorry to inform you, Congressman, there will be no Blair Bush Gate anytime soon. Walter Cronkite is retired, and the news is dictated by the rules of the new media. If you want real news, Mr. Conyers, I'd suggest a visit to Disneyland. It's from Sylvester Brown, Jr. Unfortunately, tragically, and realistically stated. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. I want to get to this Newsweek story, by the way, this thing about Newsweek backing away from the flushing of the Quran down the toilet. We'll do that in just a second. First, Sheldon in Maryland is on the line. Hey, Sheldon.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment about the way you opened this segment.
Okay.
If they had a fire at Edgar Bergen's house, I don't think if they alerted Edgar, I don't think they'd go wake up Charlie, do you?
You know, a lot of our listeners are not old enough to know who Edgar and Charlie were, other than that maybe Edgar was what's-her-name's father. Why don't you inform our listeners?
Yeah, he was the puppet back in the when I was growing up.
Yeah, back in the 30s and 40s.
The most famous, I guess.
Yeah, Edgar Bergen had a puppet. He sat on his lap by the name of Charlie McCarthy. And Candace Bergen is his daughter.
When that question first came up, that's the first thing that popped into my mind.
Yeah. Why bother telling George Jr. that the Capitol is under attack? After all, the last time we told him that, he sat there for 7 minutes and reading My Pet Goat.
Exactly.
You know, we don't want a repeat of that performance. So, you know, better just let the adults handle the situation and let Georgie continue to ride his bicycle. So, yeah. Anyway, Sheldon, thanks for the call. It's tragic in a way, isn't it, that these are the kinds of things that we're talking about. I mean, it's a sad commentary. Whatever happened to the days when you really respected the President of the United States, not just for the office. I still respect the office, but you respected the President of the United States for who he was. For the work that it took to get there, for the honesty and integrity and heart. You know, yeah, we've had a few bad presidents along the way, but, you know, looking at, you know, people who have really committed their lives to public service, people who didn't have to do it. You know, John Kennedy could have done just like, you know, the Walton heirs. He could have sat on his butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive every month and had a very comfortable life, thank you very much. Could have sent his daughter off to a fancy college and had her pay her roommate $20,000 a year to write her papers for her and get a degree like one of the Walton heirs did. I mean, you know, Jack Kennedy could have easily done that. So could Bobby. But they decided, no, public service was an important value. It was important to be of service to America. It was important to hold high the values of democracy. It was important to pay back to society some of the gifts that we had received, that they had received. I just don't get that sense at all from George Bush Jr. What I get from George Bush Jr. is a guy who was born into wealth and privilege, who, when he was speaking to that group of folks, and he said, you know, here we are. He was in this one of these, you know, $10,000-$20,000 plate dinners, and he's looking around at all the jewelry and furs, and he says, here we are in this room, the haves and the have-mores. He said, some people call you the elite. I call you my base. That he wasn't joking. That's the world into which he was born. This is a kid who was born in Connecticut, pretends he's a Texan. He was born in Connecticut, went to school in Andover, you know, very elite Northeastern prep school, went through his elementary school and high school there, went to college at Yale and Harvard. I mean, the first 25 years of his life were spent in the Northeast, and then comes down to Texas and tries to make a go in the oil business and blows it. Has two companies in a row go down in flames, both of them bailed out by friends of his father. One of them, Salman bin Laden, Osama's brother, bails out one of his companies. Other buddies of his daddy bail out his other company. So I think, I don't think he has any sense of public service. I think that Karl Rove dragged him into this job. I don't frankly think that he even wanted to be governor of Texas. You go back and read his biography, and particularly some of the unauthorized biographies. Kitty Kelly's book is very instructive. And nobody has challenged the veracity of anything in it, by the way. He's having a good time. He's playing the role. Hey, you know, it's something fun to do. And his rich buddies are making out like bandits. And it's a tragedy for the United States. But back to Newsweek. Newsweek printed this story on May 9th. And here's the entire thing. This, by the way, the Daily Coast did one of their bloggers there, Susan Hu, did a great piece on this. Investigators probing interrogation abuses at the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay have confirmed some infractions alleged in internal FBI emails that surfaced late last year. Among the previously unreported cases, sources tell Newsweek, interrogators, in an attempt to rattle suspects, flushed a Koran down the toilet and led a detainee around with a dog collar and dog leash. So now 15 people have died in riots in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Among the previously unreported cases, sources tell Newsweek, interrogators, in an attempt to rattle suspects, flushed a Koran down the toilet and led a detainee around with a dog collar and dog leash. Okay. So now 15 people have died in riots in Pakistan and Afghanistan as a result of this report. Because it got picked up by Al Jazeera, and it's got picked up by a bunch of other Arabic news sources. And in those countries, in Saudi Arabia, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, if you flush a Koran down the toilet, you can be beheaded. Every Friday afternoon in Saudi Arabia, they have the public beheadings. And they will chop your head off for even speaking ill about the Koran. They're very serious about this. And the same thing in Afghanistan. So, you know, Newsweek is now backing away. Because people are dying. They are burning American flags. Their forces are in danger, he said. But Susan Hu, this blogger on Daily Kos, goes back. And a statement by Shaki Rasul Ashif Abdul and some other guy whose name I can't pronounce. The same thing. The disrespect of the Koran by guards at Camp X-Ray was one of the factors prompting a hunger strike. This is why they had a hunger strike. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to Talk Radio for the Rest of Us, the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. If you have an issue you would like to bring to the fore, something you would like America to be pondering, thinking about, contemplating, arguing over, gesticulating about, mentally masticating, Billy in Santa Cruz on the line. Hey, Billy.
Hi. Susan Hu.
Yeah, she's right down the street from Joe What?
Yeah, well, who? Don't keep it to yourself. Share it with the rest of us. Okay. All right. How do you not do that? I mean, if you're old enough to remember Abbott and Costello, you got to do it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So I don't understand. Why are we talking about Newsweek when we should be talking about the fact that people think that everything's written in a magazine is necessarily right, or more importantly, if they flush the Quran a day down the toilet, it's not worth a human life.
Yeah.
Why doesn't somebody tell these people to straighten out? Because I'll tell you what I'm doing. Every time there's a suicide bomber, every time one of those guys comes from Saudi Arabia and blows up our kids in Iraq and elsewhere, I'm going to defecate on the piece of the Quran. And every time the Christians in America say it's a Christian nation, I'm going to tear a page out of, Revelations. And every time the administration lies in America, every time Bush tells another lie, I'm going to cut a piece off of my flag. Who's going to kill me first?
Yeah, well, I suspect, Billy, that all three of them are going to come after you.
And should they? What kind of world do we live in, Tom?
I know, it's nuts. It's nuts. The reality, Billy, is, and I know your take on religion and all that, but the reality is that the vast majority of people who are members of any of those religions, and I think you exempted Judaism from that, and so let's toss them in there as well.
That's right. Every time Israel screws up, I'm taking a page from Leviticus.
There you go. Or actually, I'd say go for the book of Joshua. You want the most toxic book in there. He's the guy that God kept telling him to kill more people and kill the women and kill the children and kill the dogs,
Point.
But my point, just a second. The major point, I think, is that the vast majority of people who are members of any of these religions are not the nutcases that we're hearing about. They're not the ones who are out killing people.
They
need to
speak up.
Well, I agree.
Let's
not paint all religion with that brush.
Here's the bottom line. People don't like to be offended. I don't think I like it, but let me tell you something. I don't expect the world to order itself so as not to offer me offense. It's okay to be offended. You'll manage. You'll live another day. But to go out and kill, all this talk about the culture of life, oh, my God. In the name of God, all we do is kill people.
Right. Then they're killing abortion doctors to protect life.
Exactly. So, I'm not picking on the Arabs today or on the Muslims. I'm picking on everybody who's whatever their faith is, thinks that's more important than another human life. You're wrong, you are sick, and you're what's wrong with the world. Please go away.
Okay. Well Thanks, said, buddy. Billy. Thanks a lot. Good rant. Yeah. It's a good rant. Billy ought to get on the radio. You could do a great Michael Savage on the left. The religious right is targeting John McCain. John McCain has been outspoken in opposing the nuclear option to abolish the judicial filibuster. Yes, this gets back to this idea of, is the Bush administration being run like the mafia, or is it being run like government? Is it being run like a crime family, or is it being run like a government institution? And increasingly, the evidence is indicating it's being run like the mob. Here's what John McCain said on ABC's This Week this morning. He says, now this now turns the Senate, if we set this precedent, into basically a body where the majority rules. And what he's talking about is he says, but I know there's a strong desire to avoid a confrontation that changes fundamentally the way the Senate does business. And, it says this is unprecedented. In response, the religious right has accused John McCain of trying to prevent people who believe in God from serving on the federal bench, which is absurd. But here it is, the National Right to Life website. Father Frank Pavone, head of Priests for Life, told NLR News, it is unfortunate that Senator McCain has joined those senators who are trying to prevent godly men and women nominated by the president and supported by a majority of senators from serving on our nation's court. There's not going to be a church in America that's not going to know exactly who those senators are. Yeah.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Several crucial moments in the judicial career of Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen have been guided by the hand of Karl Rove, says the New York Times. Welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Several crucial moments in the judicial career of Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen Karl Rove. You get this? Indeed, thanks in large part to Rove. This is from the Center for American Progress today. In large part to Rove, the once unknown serial activist Texas judge is today one of seven nominees at the heart of the Senate's battle over the nuclear option. According to the Times, Rove helped launch Owen's career, selecting her as a candidate in the course of his 1990s campaign to turn the Texas Supreme Court into a business-friendly stronghold, such as it is at this moment. Rove then offered her the services of his consulting firm and raised nearly $1 million for Priscilla Owen's campaign. Karl Rove raised $1 million for Priscilla Owen's campaign as part of his campaign to turn the Texas Supreme Court into a business-friendly place. Later, Rove would overrule then-White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez in choosing Owen as one of President Bush's very first appeals court nominees. Pretty startling stuff here. Schwarzenegger's environmental colonialism. In the Rocky Mountain West, energy companies have proposed more than two dozen power plants that would be fueled by coal, a high-polluting fossil fuel that is a major contributor to global warming. Now California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has pledged support for a proposed 1,300-mile electricity transmission line that would allow power from polluting plants located in Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada to flow into California. Joe Desmond, the governor's energy advisor, claims that all the plants will be high-tech plants that will get the goal of near-zero emissions. Right. You can't get near-zero emissions by burning coal. Sorry, it's just not possible. In fact, the San Francisco Chronicle reports that of 31 coal-based plants, proposals now in various stages of permitting process, none currently plans on using the advanced technology Desmond mentioned. None. As in zero. And it continues on. The judiciary grandstanding continues. We'll get into that in just a minute. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Deb in Leander, Texas is on the line. Hey, Deb, what's up?
Hey, I just want to say that I went on, well, first of all, I live in Williamson County, Texas, which is probably one of the most conservative areas in the country.
Uh-huh.
My legislators are John Carter, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, and Cornyn.
Oh, my goodness. You have my sympathy. It's like when I lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and my congressman was Newt Gingrich.
Yeah. Well, I went on the senators' websites yesterday to send them my comments on the nuclear option, even though, you know, like crying in the wind. But on their websites, they have a drop-down of what topic you're writing to them on.
Mm-hmm.
And they frame the conversation such as judicial nominees. They never have an option for filibuster.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't come up with the topic of the email that you're sending them. You have to pick from one of their topics.
Well, they do have an other, or you can fill it in yourself. But if people are just going on what they suggest they want to hear about,
right?
Filibuster is not one of them.
That's interesting. On the other hand, you know, it probably makes a certain amount of sense if they're getting a lot of constituent feedback. And they have to be able to sort it. I mean, if you get,
they probably have rules and things that sort.
Yeah, if you get 20 or 30,000 emails and all of them have different headers and you're not sure how to categorize them, I mean, it would take a lot of staff people a lot of hours to figure out what's going on. Whereas if you simply put them all into the category of judicial nominees and it was basically, you know, pro or con, you know, they're with us, they're with the Republicans on this, they're with the Democrats on this, or they're with, you know, I think that they could probably sort it fairly easily, and that's probably what they're trying to do. Did you see this as like some very, very negative thing, or?
I'm sure administratively what you're saying is absolutely true.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that they limit the conversation
mm-hmm.
by categorizing your comments into judicial appointments rather than, and not even having a topic for what is probably one of the biggest issues and, you know, things we should be concerned about constitutionally.
Yeah. Have you tried calling their office and asking them about this?
No, I haven't.
Let me give you the phone number. It's toll free. Won't cost you a penny. It's 1-877. It's one of the toll free lines, you know, 877 SOB U, the letter U, SOB.
Mm-hmm.
1-877 SOB U SOB. And that really and truly is the telephone number of Capitol Hill. It's the toll-free number. It's not generally published. It's the old Senate Office Building number, which is why it's SOB. It actually stands for Senate Office Building, not son of a, you know, whatever. But it's 1-877-SOB-USOB. And that will get you the Capitol Hill operator. And then you simply ask for whichever member of Congress you want. That number will get you to all of them. It'll also get you to the president or to the, you know, the office of the White House or the vice president's office. And any member of the House or of the Senate, simply ask for the person that you want, and they'll connect you.
Well, thanks.
So, you know, call them up and point this out, and I would be fascinated to hear what you find out.
Okay.
You know, let's find out what's going on with this. You know, whether this is just their way of trying to make it easier to sort things out and actually keep their finger on the pulse of their constituents, which actually might be a good thing. They really want to know what's going on, and they have to have some sort of organizational system to do it, or whether it's really more of a filter to, you know, keep out the crackpots like you and me who might want to suggest to them that we should have democracy in America.
God
forbid. Yes. Not on the agenda of most conservatives these days.
No.
Okay. Deb, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Okay.
Let us know what happens.
Okay.
Yeah, have a good one. Oh, my goodness. Yes. Democracy? What? Democracy? No. It's like you hear these cons on these right-wing talk shows, you know, these right-wing shows. It's not a democracy we live in. It's a republic. Yes. It's, don't call her a democracy. It's a republic. It's not like the word Democrat. It's like the word Republican. You see, that's the kind of country we live in. This going back to one of Frank Luntz's early efforts on behalf of Newt Gingrich back in the 1980s. When he discovered that when you said democratic, people thought that was a good thing. And therefore, the cons stopped referring to Democrats as democratic, or as stopped referring to members of the Democratic Party as members of the Democratic Party, and instead started calling them members of the Democrat Party. There is no such thing as the Democrat Party. Never was, never will be. It's called the Democratic Party. It used to be called the Democratic Republican Party, oddly enough, from its inception around 1798 until the 1820s, late 1820s, early 1830s. And then they just stopped using the word Republican and started, you know, just called themselves simply the Democratic Party. It was founded by Thomas Jefferson. He brought together in the late 1790s. When he was vice president under John Adams and a bitter foe of John Adams. This was before the reform of the Electoral College, whenever whoever got the most votes was president, whoever got the second most votes was vice president. Jefferson got the second most votes. It wasn't like he ran together with Adams. He despised Adams by that point. And so Jefferson brought together these factions that had sprung up to oppose the Federalists. The Federalists, of course, being John Adams and his friends. The Federalists being in favor of concentrated federal power. The Federalists saying that, you know, the Senate shouldn't be elected by the people. The Federalists being very worried about the rabble. And so Jefferson pulled together. And so one of the factions that emerged was the Republicans. And one of the who said, hey, you know, we live in a republic. And the other was the Democrats and who said, hey, we live in a democracy. And he pulled them together as the Democratic Republicans. And so, and for, you know, 200 and some odd years, they were referred to as Democrats. Oddly enough, you go back to the whitehouse.gov website and look at the biography of the early presidents, and you'll discover that Thomas Jefferson, according to George Bush's White House, was a Republican. And the president who followed him, James Madison, was a Republican. And the president who followed him, James Monroe, was a Republican. And the president who followed him, I believe it was Zachary Taylor, was a Republican. I'm sorry, they were all Democrats. They called themselves Democrats. Well, Madison arguably called himself a Republican. He called himself a Democratic Republican. He talked about Republican values and Republican principles. But But the reality is that they were all members of the party that is today called the Democratic Party. But Frank Luntz discovered that when you say Democratic, that sounds kind of good, you know, Democratic. And now even the news media is picking this up. And they're saying people who are in the Democrat Party. There is no Democrat Party. It's called the National Democratic Party. You can always tell the bias of a news organization or the lack of journalistic education of a member of the press by how they refer to Democrats. Whether they refer to them as members of the Democrat Party or the Democratic Party. I mean, this is the, you know, Luntz did his focus grouping on this, and Newt Gingrich ran with it, and Limbaugh picked up the ball, and here we are today. Here we are today, moving right along. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great.
Generally, I want to agree with you, but...
But?
I need to pick at you for one little thing today.
Go for it.
It's kind of bugged me for a while. You keep on pointing out that well, Adams was scared of the rabble. Well, a lot of people are, and I'm scared of the rabble. I'm scared of the rabble I'm seeing right now. This was the thing that they were talking about, this lunatic behavior where you have an ideologue drumming up people who really don't know what the hell is going on, which is comes out remarkably clearly in the PIPA survey. Where you still have a majority of people who believe idiotic things like, oh, yes, well, of course we found WMD in Iraq. And of course, Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. And that was the whole idea of trying to calm the rabble down, if you will.
Actually, there was a very strong difference of opinion, Mike, back then. Jefferson's position was, if the rabble are well-informed, if you have a functioning free press, you need not ever fear the rabble. In fact, he went so far as to say, if I had to choose between living in a nation with newspapers and no government or a nation with government and no newspapers, I would choose the former. And so Jefferson's point was, if you have a well-informed populace, then they will ultimately always make the right decisions. They may make a few wrong decisions along the way, but it's a self-correcting system. Adams, on the other hand, was a believer that you have to have this firm iron hand, that a small plutocratic bunch, a small aristocratic bunch, a bunch who know better, should be running the government. And the big difference in Adams' mind and Hamilton's mind and the early conservatives, and for that matter, today's conservatives, the big difference between them and the Tories, the royalists, was that the Tories were saying, and that hand around the throat of democracy, that hand that guides the ship of state, should be, the Tories, the aristocrats, were saying, that should be hereditary, that people are born with great wealth, they're born with power, they learn at an early age about noblesse oblige, about the obligation that comes with nobility and the obligation to serve, which in some ways you actually saw in the Kennedy family and in the Bush family, that sense of an obligation to give back, at least in Bush Sr. Now, on the other hand, Jefferson and many of the other Democrats said, no. Adams, let me separate this. Adams disagreed with the Tories. Adams and Hamilton disagreed with the Tories in that the Tories were saying, yes, there needs to be a small aristocratic clique running the country, and it should be hereditary, whereas Adams and Hamilton were saying, yes, there should be a small aristocratic clique running the country, but it should be a meritocracy. We should find the smartest people among us and make them the small elite that rule us. And Jefferson was saying, you're both wrong. There should be no small elite ruling us. The people should rule, period. And the best way to ensure democracy and rule of the people is by having a free and unfettered press.
Right. But, see, that's the whole point, and you've touched on it several times, a well-informed public, and we have anything but. There are...
Right, but that doesn't mean that we go back to an aristocracy. It means we create a well-informed public, which is why I'm doing this radio show 6 hours a day.
Correct. I'm saying that's the thing. People who listen to yourself, for example, they actually have an idea of what the heck is going on out here.
Right.
And I have no problem with that. The well-informed should be making decisions. But over the last 30 years, the extreme right-wingers, the fascists essentially in this country, are pushing to disinform the public, to keep them blinded to what's really going on.
Sure, and they always have. I mean, it happened under the Democratic administration of Woodrow Wilson with World War I. I mean, this is nothing new. And we need to stand up to it, just like the Republicans tried to stand up to Woodrow Wilson and say, hey, wait a minute, it's propaganda. This isn't a war that we need. We don't want to participate in, you know, quack, quack, quack. It's, yeah, I'm agreeing with you. However, be very careful, because where your logic will lead is to an aristocracy of the well-informed, which is Hamilton and Madison, or Hamilton and Adams' meritocracy. And that's not democracy.
True.
Well, we need to be looking at the cause, not the symptom. The symptom is the fact that you know, things aren't happening democratically. You've got these, you know, right-wing fringes, these lunatic groups. But the cause is a lack of good information. And that's the point that we need to be addressing. Don't blame the victim here. Am I making sense, Mike?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you. I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you. And we got to move along. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people, like Mike, the place where smart people get their news. Seriously, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. Infrastructure. The reality? Almost 4 years after September 11, 2001, and 2 years after the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, the Bush administration's record on Homeland Security is one of too much talk, bumbling, and little action and funding. For example, the rhetoric. Tom Ridge went up to Canada. I'm quoting George W. Bush, January 25th of 2002. Tom Ridge went up to Canada. He went up with Canada, and we're talking about a new border initiative with our friends. We're analyzing every aspect of the border and making sure that the effort is seamless, the communication is real, and that the enforcement is strong. End quote. Since 9/11, here's the reality. Since 9/11, Congress provided an additional $308 million to beef up security on our northern border and add Border Patrol agents, inspectors, and equipment. George Bush, Jr. requested only one-third of this funding, and today over $36 million of it remains unspent due to the administration's slowness. The 2001 Patriot Act called for tripling inspectors and agents on our northern border. No Bush budget ever proposed to meet this goal. Today, there are almost 2,000 fewer inspectors than called for in the Patriot Act. Not that I'm a fan of the Patriot Act, but, you know, at least, you know, if you're going to say you're going to do something, do it. The White House continues to have no plan to identify how many more agents and inspectors and how much new technology are needed to adequately guard our northern and southern borders. The intelligence reform law requires 2,000 additional border agents and 800 new immigration investigators. The Bush budget asks for only 326 new personnel. In addition, the administration seems to prefer to move agents and investigators around, such as the over 200 agents temporarily moved to Arizona as part of that initiative, which simply creates new holes in the border rather than permanently addressing the problem. This is just one example of many. This is from Congressman David Obey, Democrat of Wisconsin. He's got this 14-page document of Bush's promises and his failures. It is absolutely mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. I don't see a website for it. We'll have to get it and post it on our message board at tomhartman.com. Thanks for being with us today, friends. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.